Classic FM was one of the most important things that could have happened to British culture. And musicians learn to make music with people by getting into rhythm with them. I do wonder what the world might be like now if women had had opportunities 30 years ago.
Radio Moments, conversations in which you hear from those who made a difference. Lisa Kerr.
So I was born in Edinburgh, overlooking the Portobello Beach. Very early, moved to a little village called Pencaitland in East Lothian, and I think had a proper idyllic childhood. We would spend our summer holidays building dens out of straw bales, and I can remember the summer holidays being defined by the barley harvest and whether we were running through the tall barley before it was cut or reshaping the neat rows of straw that had been left into houses, and going to the local village primary school and then finding the thing that was mine, which was music. I actually started learning the cello when I think was about four. Not affluent at all. I remember getting into terrible trouble when I ate a chocolate biscuit from the cupboard. You know, she bought enough chocolate biscuits that there was one a day for packed lunches. I remember watching a programme about Cheetham School of Music when I think was in about primary six, so I'd have been about 10, and saying to my dad, oh, that's the school I want to go to. And he said, well, the funny thing is I'm just in the process of setting up, or maybe have just set up one of those in Edinburgh. He was in music education in Edinburgh. And so I went to what is now the City of Edinburgh Music School at Broughton High School, right opposite Fettes. And it was a state school. It remains one of Scotland's national music schools. There are now five. I was in this little music unit. It was known as The Unit. And there were sort of two or three kids a year from within a school of 1,000. It was a slightly odd existence. I was terribly bullied, and I remember being beaten up once and sort of left in the road having been beaten up just because of not quite fitting in. I was quite musical. I was a feminist then as I am now. I fought a big battle to be allowed to wear trousers to school. I guess I sort of stood up for what I believed in.
Don't forget, if you'd like a special song for you as you're driving homewards, or even if you're sitting in the house at this time, drop me a line, Mike Gower, Radio 4th, PO Box 194, Edinburgh, and we'll do the needful for you.
I think I listened to Radio 4th really, really early. And I remember actually someone talking about Radio 4, and I had never heard of Radio 4. And so I actually thought they were talking about Radio 4th. And I think Radio 4th was just about the only thing I used to listen to. Although we used to get my parents split up quite early in my secondary education. And another boy in my village used to go to the same school in Edinburgh. And it was a 45-minute drive into Edinburgh. And his dad would take us in. And he listens to Derek Jameson on the Radio 2 Breakfast Show. And my goodness, the memories I have of listening to Derek Jameson.
Breakfast listening, Radio 2, Derek Jameson.
Morning.
I remember thinking he was terribly sexist and just feeling squeamishly uncomfortable and just always thinking, would you just please put something else on?
Everybody's talking. That was Harry Nilsson, and this is Derek Jameson starting a new job today.
I remember really consciously deciding I wasn't going to apply for Oxbridge. I completely fell in love with York, and it was the best move I ever made. And if I was the outsider at school, I was definitely the insider at York, and I completely fitted in there. I ran every society going, played in every ensemble I possibly could, just felt completely at home and completely myself.
Latest hits and greatest memories now. Hits and memories, hear them on Radio 4.
I think the move into radio was the first really significant junction in my life. I think to understand it, you have to know that I started working in radio when I was 14, 15, slightly helped by my dad, who'd been in charge of a very significant broadcast that Radio 4th had done with the Edinburgh Secondary Schools Orchestra of Rick Wakeman's Journey to the Centre of the Earth. For this school orchestra to be broadcasting this live on Radio 4th tells you a lot about the state of music education at the time and a lot about the state of the local radio sector at the time. And I think through that, my dad introduced me to Jay Crawford at Radio 4th, and he got me in for some sort of work experience. And very quickly, I got myself into that radio station.
First of all, I'd like to play for you a band that I think are fast up and coming, and they're well worth going along to see. They're going to be appearing at Buster Brown's in Edinburgh tomorrow night. They're called The Finns.
Radio 4th was huge. It seemed to be absolutely central to everything that was happening locally. Radio 4th was an amazing place to be in the late 80s, early 90s. It's a beautiful Georgian building on 4th Street. I mean, you couldn't make it up, could you? Radio 4th on 4th Street. And the studios were in the basement. So you'd come into reception, you could see through a glass wall on your left to the newsroom. The fearsome Maureen on reception, but she had an absolute heart of gold. And then you'd go up the stairs. On the first floor was the sales force. And I used to scurry past them because I didn't at that point really understand what they did. And they were very scary. And then on the top floor was programming, where there was the typewriter. I can still see the typewriter that I used to write the scripts for Hot in the City on. And through the archway, you went to Colin Somerville and Jan's music library. And then through the glass doors into the record library itself. One of my jobs was to catalogue the record library, and when I was on work experience there when I was about 15, I think. And then two flights down and then another flight down into the basement, the studios, and I can still remember I won't say it in case it's still the same code, I can still remember the code, how you work out what the code is for the door to get into the studios. To be a teenage girl who was working there on work experience, it felt really special. There were road shows and the phone lines were always jammed. I remember I used to work the phones for some kind of swap shop thing that we used to do on a weekday morning between 9 and 10. And the phones were just jammed the whole time. And while I was at university, every summer I was going back to Radio 4th and doing their Edinburgh Festival coverage. I worked with a chap called John Collins, who I think is one of the most underrated producers in Scottish radio and a really great guy and again, still a really good friend of mine. He came up with this concept of this show for the Edinburgh Festival called Hot in the City, and it was half an hour during the Edinburgh Festival in the summer of 1993. Half an hour of speech radio that just didn't stop. And when I was working on that, Classic FM had just launched and obviously they were wanting to come and do the Edinburgh Festival. And Radio 4th, trying to make some money, rented them our studio for the slot that John and I used to pre-record the top of the show segment, and I was really cross about it. But Classic said, well, you know, we're looking for a new producer, and there's a chap called John Bache. We'd like you to have a cup of coffee with him. Turned out to be a pint of Guinness, actually. And that was how I got into Classic. Classic took me on as a producer. £12,000 a year. I think I'd been to London twice before. I phoned everybody I knew from every other part of my life and managed to get a room in a flat in Hampstead. Basement flat, it must be said. When I started at Classic, I was engaged to work the evening shift and produce the evening concert and Michael Mappin's programme, which ran from 10 till 1. So I was around during the day and working at night. And so I didn't really have a social life when I first moved to London. I think I had mixed success at Classic, to be honest. I don't think he would mind me saying it, because we found an equilibrium later, but Michael Mappin and I didn't get on. And I think, you know, Michael himself was a radio producer and fundamentally didn't enjoy being produced by me. And actually, why should he? Because he was a fellow music graduate and he knew as much about the music as I did. And he knew more about radio at that point than I did, I think. But my route into others was through music. And that was where I made the connection. So, you know, Henry Kelly would come in to prepare for his show and he'd give me his running order and I would tell him little anecdotes about the composers or the music.
I got the same buzz every day of the week that I got on the 7th of September 1992. That's imprinted on our memory because it was day one and we were just so nervous, I cannot tell you.
But I also, very early on, was thrown into the deep end by John Bache in terms of driving the output in the evenings. I think my second day at Classic, he made me drive the desk for the evening sequence, which was a combination of live and pre-recorded output. And I quite quickly became quite an accomplished tech op. And I think that's musicians' ears. I think musicians do make good tech ops because they can really hear the ebb and flow of the sound. So I sort of found my route into those relationships, first of all through music and then through technical proficiency. And one of my greatest achievements was teaching Angela Rippon to self-op.
You get introduced to more and more music. My musical vocabulary, my musical catalogue has increased so much with music that's been
added. I did think that I, because I was quite straightforward with people and I hope never pretended to be something I wasn't, that I was able to build relationships. And I built a particularly strong relationship with Sarah Lucas, whom I produced on Saturday Breakfast. And I also had a fabulous working relationship with Paul Gambaccini. And I remember the last Saturday I worked for Classic, and he was doing his classical music chart, and he was doing his big countdown at the end of the show. And at the very end of the show, he did this big piece about me and me leaving. And I just about fell off my chair. And I remember my mum phoning me up afterwards in absolute tears. I thought Classic FM was one of the most important things that could have happened to British culture, I have to say. Because classical music, when I was at school, was seen as niche and a bit odd. And Classic FM has given everybody the opportunity to love classical music in a way that I think we should and that enriches everybody's life. The snobbery that exists around classical music fundamentally misunderstands the place that it had in life when it was being written. I remember one of the most lovely people I worked with, and he even mentioned me in his autobiography. I was so chuffed. It was John Julius Norwich, and he presented the evening concert, and through him I got to know his daughter Artemis Cooper, who's a wonderful biographer, and his son-in-law Anthony Beaver, the historian. And I remember having Sunday lunch with their family once, and so kind of having that conversation about whether Classic FM was sort of dumbing down classical music. And it was really great to be able to say, you do know that when, and I'm going to get these pieces wrong, but when Beethoven wrote his Fifth Symphony, the premiere only included the first movement, and then there was the third movement of the Emperor Piano Concerto, and then there was a little bit of that piece and a little bit of that. You know, this idea that we sort of had, certainly when I was growing up, that you should only listen to classical music sitting in complete silence from the beginning to the very end, and you must listen to every movement in totality. That's not how it was. So when I joined Classic, GWR was a major shareholder, and DMGT was as well, but there were still lots of other shareholders. The chief exec was a man called John Spearman.
The success of Classic FM had an impact that was really very widely felt. And one of the reasons for that was the fact that our success was a surprise.
Michael Bucht was the programme controller. And as a producer, it was really clear that my boss was Michael Bucht.
Broadcasting is a great privilege. You've got a chance to talk to the whole world if you can persuade them to listen to you. And that gives you huge power and enormous responsibilities.
It was rock and roll radio. He was really clear this was a rock and roll format that happened to play classical music. And the discipline that we had to have around the clock hour was absolutely extraordinary. And I used to love playing with that and working out how I could make the music fit into that format through the repertoire knowledge that I had, which wasn't amazing repertoire knowledge. And I think there were many others that knew more than I did. But I didn't see it as a straitjacket. I saw it as a route to real creativity. Just remembered the other day about a concert in Rotterdam that I was producing, and I remember running through the concert hall because the advert break started playing back through the presenter's headphones while we were in a particularly quiet movement of a Brahms symphony, and having to run in high heels and an evening dress down three flights of stairs to where the sound engineer was in the basement to stop it happening. You know, that sort of experience when you're 21 is really, really amazing. So the move from Classic came about through one of those other overlaps. I suppose when I left university, I had this love of radio and this love of music, and Classic allowed me to do both. I suppose it was inevitable that at some point I'd have to choose. Sarah Lucas, whose breakfast show I was producing, invited me to go on holiday with her to their family holiday home in France one summer. And I got to know her husband, David Lucas, at that point. And David was setting up a company to run the new radio station for the Channel Tunnel, Channel Travel Radio, and was looking for someone to come and be the first manager of that. And he asked if I would want to do that. And I said yes. So 2 years and 3 months after joining Classic, I went off to become MD of this little radio company. And it was 51% owned by David, 49% owned by Lynx FM. If I look back to the beginning of my radio career, it was Tom Steele at Radio 4th who really believed in me. And it was Michael Bucht who really believed in me at Classic FM. And then David Lucas, who saw that I could be something other than a radio producer and invited me to come and join him setting up radio services. And that was really my first taste, effectively, of business.
Your fast route to the best information. This is Channel Travel Radio, Eurotunnel's round-the-clock radio station.
Channel Travel Radio was the radio station for all cross-channel travellers. And this was the basis on which the Radio Authority had actually allowed Eurotunnel to hold a licence, which was basically designed to persuade people to use the Channel Tunnel because they fundamentally believed that if you had an objective choice between going by sea or by tunnel, then you would choose the tunnel. So all you had to do was present the information about how you could just turn up and go versus go on a ferry and possibly be seasick. And so this radio station was set up, and it was a really unique transmission system that broadcast directionally along the M20 on 107.8 FM. And was 24-hour day live, but using EncoDAD's very early automated playout system. And I joined Channel Travel in November 95. I suppose I got into general management really young. I was 22 when I joined Channel Travel Radio. I got a lot of advice from David about what to do. And David was quite hands-on as a chairman, but in a really supportive way. And there was a bit of support from Lynx, but Lynx were quite passive as a shareholder. I guess I got one or two mentors quite early. So two people that were really involved in setting up the radio station were Richard Johnson, who was at Channel 103 at the time in Jersey, and Chris Carnegie, who was at Spire. I suspect I went to them for advice. But there was something about having been, you know, at Radio 4 for so long, having been at university, you know, I was running all kinds of societies at university. So I think I was quite persuasive, but I would hit problems and not know what to do. And I do remember phoning Richard quite regularly. And I also was part of the Eurotunnel family. And there were a number of managers at Eurotunnel who really took me under their wing. And there was also, I also had a really smart colleague, a woman called Michaela Segal, a French woman. And she was really wise. And I think she probably knocked me into shape a bit. We were known as the frog and the dragon, self-styled, her being French and me being a bit fiery from time to time.
Channel Travel Radio is operated by Radio Services on behalf of Eurotunnel.
David was really clear that Channel Travel Radio was a sort of launch pad from which he wanted to grow a business. David and Sarah owned the intellectual property to a game show format called Take Your Pick, which Sarah's dad had set up on television.
So let's meet our first contestant. A nice welcome, please.
And they are really smart people. And David was ambitious to set up this radio group. And so we basically began applying for radio licences and setting up consortia here, there and everywhere. And we won them. They were all sort of joint ventures with different people. But we were kind of on a roll for a good few years. And the fact that I had enough money to buy my first house was because I was able to invest as a teeny shareholder in these radio stations. And when they eventually began to be sold, that gave me the money to put a deposit down. So there was Neptune Radio in Dover and Folkestone. There was CTFM in Canterbury. There was Chelmer FM in Chelmsford. Thames in Kingston-upon-Thames, Arrow FM in Hastings.
Arrow FM, Hastings.
And then we became involved in Sovereign in Eastbourne, in what then went on to become the Swan in High Wycombe. And then, of course, we joined forces with TLRC. I found launching radio stations really challenging. I mean, I hadn't done it before. That was a period of immense growth for the radio sector. I'd started out running this little radio station in the control tower at Eurotunnel, and then, you know, starting to set up all these radio stations, hiring good people, that was a challenge. Really getting my head around the commercial aspect of things. I was given quite a lot of autonomy around the capital setup and the capital build, and I made a real mistake with one of them. And one of the companies ended up having to refinance. I can remember the moment when I realised that I'd really got some stuff wrong and I'd significantly overspent on the capex for this radio station. And actually, when I talk about that story quite a bit when I'm talking to students now or if I'm giving talks about my career. And I talk about it being the point when you realise that the autonomy you've got goes beyond the knowledge that you have. And I think there's a responsibility, not just as the person who's been given that responsibility to say, I need help. But I think there's a real responsibility on the people who've delegated a task to someone to make sure that that person is okay. I remember waking up in the middle of the night, I'd gone to stay with my mum, and not quite, but almost being physically sick. And I don't really remember the forgiveness that I got, but I must have got forgiveness for it. And I must have asked for help. And we just ended up refinancing the business. But it really didn't help the cash flow of that business for a long time as a result of that mistake. It does make you doubly determined not to do it again. And I think you absolutely have to learn from those situations. I suppose I sort of pinch myself, really. There was this whole era of the Radio Authority opening up this whole new bit of the wave band, and therefore opening up a whole new kind of broadcasting. And I think that was a real challenge for the whole sector at that point, was to think, how can we make something work that's just right for now? And I think those radio stations were just right for their time. And for me, it was all about the cost of the transmission equipment coming down and the introduction of semi-automation. And if those two things hadn't happened, those radio stations couldn't have happened. And as a result, there was a huge amount of creativity that came into the industry, and new talent that came into the industry. And quite a lot of people, I wasn't one of them, but quite a lot of people made quite a lot of money out of that. And I think it was a time of real innovation and excitement. And I can think of sort of three or four really innovative things that technological change allowed me to do that I would feel really proud of. That creativity, making the most of an opportunity, making the most of a change in external circumstances, I think is definitely something that I've taken through the rest of my career. So we were really successful at growing radio services and then becoming part of Radio Investments. And we had a lot of fun joining TLRC and Radio Investments together. And one of our minority shareholders was GMG. And then there came a point of a change in ownership and a change in leadership. And John Myers came in as our chief executive. And so Ian Axon and I reported direct to him. And I think one of those really inevitable things that happens in all organisations, and I always say this to people who end up in leadership positions, you have to recognise that when you're at the top, when there's a change in ownership or a fundamental change in structure, it's almost inevitable that the person at the top will go. They'll probably go at some point, unless the new owner has bought in because of that person. And it was really clear that GMG hadn't bought into Radio Services, Radio Investments, TLRC because of the management. They'd bought in because of the assets. And so I was able to find a way to leave that organisation on really good terms. I think it was 2001, so I wasn't quite 30. I'd just got married, just moved house. My husband was in the armed forces and so was away quite a lot. And I thought, well, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'll do something. I don't remember being concerned, but I had a good contract that meant that I had a degree of financial stability. And so I didn't have children at that point. You know, we had a chunky mortgage, just got married. It'd be interesting to ask my husband whether he remembers me being anxious. I guess I just thought, oh, maybe I'll do something different. Maybe I'll go and train to be a lawyer. I've always wanted to be a lawyer. I've always regretted not being a lawyer. I think I'd have been a good lawyer. Maybe I'll do something completely different. But, you know, literally the day after I sent the letters, I've always tried to be very courteous at work. So anytime I left an organisation, I've always sort of written to the people that I've worked with and said, thank you very much. And I got loads of lovely letters when I left Radio Services. I still got them, actually. I mean, quite early in my time at Radio Services, I was invited to go to the AGM of what was called the AIRC, the Association of Independent Radio Contractors. And I remember going up to London and sitting in this very grand hotel room. And even though I'd worked at Classic, I'd never sort of been in that kind of corporate environment. And being really excited by the stuff that Paul Brown and the rest of his team, Rochelle Fox and others, were talking about at that time. And at my first meeting, putting up my hand and asking a question and making a contribution, you'll be surprised to hear that I thought I had something to say. And really very early in my time at Radio Services, getting engaged in AIRC. And it was at that very first meeting I went to that it changed to the Commercial Radio Companies Association. So all the time that I was at Radio Services, I used to love going to the AGMs and the conferences, and not just because of the tremendous fun that we had, but because I loved being part of an industry. I loved being part of shaping the future and discussing the really gnarly policy issue. And that was the point that community radio was just coming online. And I had real concerns as an operator of small-scale local radio about the way that community radio was being proposed to be brought in. And it seemed, I believe really strongly, that it was too early in the life of those tiny local commercial radio stations, which were incredibly fragile and which hadn't managed to replicate the commercial success of some of the bigger stations upon which they were modelled, stations like Spire FM. And I was really worried about it, and I became very passionate about it at CRCA events. And I think that was why Paul Brown called me when I left radio services. It was that lovely, treacly voice of his, and said, would you be interested in some part-time work? And I thought, part-time work, a little bit of going back to London again, that might be quite fun. My very first task was around the ownership rules. And I remember Paul Brown sending me a paper that was going to go to the CRCA board maybe the week after, with the proposal around the way that they wanted to go back to the Radio Authority. This was all the negotiation that was going on in the 2003 Communications Act to change the ownership rules to allow greater consolidation within the commercial radio industry. And a lot of work had been done by a couple of the board members at CRCA with Paul on this proposed ownership rule. And I remember him sending it through to me and saying, we're going to be looking at this next week, sort of, you know, get your head around it. And I remember getting in touch with him and saying, I think there's a problem. I remember producing a document on the computer, which was the most complicated thing I had ever tried to produce, to do a sort of diagram, an ownership diagram of the radio sector. And I had to go back to the CRC board at my very first board meeting and say, I think actually you've got this wrong. I mean, not fundamentally wrong. I think the principle is right. But if you try and apply it in this detailed way, here are the unintended consequences. And everyone got it immediately. It was brilliant. And we changed slightly the tack that we were going to take. We went into the argument about how we thought it should be done. And I found that so exhilarating. And working with Paul Brown, I mentioned earlier, Tom Steele at Radio 4th, Michael Bucht at Classic FM, David Lucas at Radio Services, Paul Brown, another person who saw in me something I didn't see in myself, that I could make this transition from being a relatively mediocre manager of radio stations into someone who could really take public affairs and policy and eventually strategy for the sector forwards.
The commercial radio industry was going through an interesting time. First of all, it had started to make money, and we were anxious to keep doing so. But the BBC were starting to become aggressive.
I didn't know that I could do that, and he did. And he gave me the platform and the support, and, you know, sometimes the pretty robust feedback to make sure that I could do it well. And that opened up radio in a new way to me. When I left music school, I very consciously made the choice not to go to music college and study playing, because I didn't find playing intellectually stimulating enough. And I know that might sound a bit pretentious, but it didn't do it for me. I mean, playing was wonderful and enjoyable and challenging, but I wasn't a good enough player, and it didn't fire the right bits of my brain. Being a radio producer, I think the same. You know, I found it really interesting and challenging, and I loved it, but I wasn't brilliant at it. And David Lucas, through going to radio services, found a different channel for me. And so at all these stages, it was finding what the next thing is that would give me the next level of challenge. And moving into policy at CRCA, which eventually then went on to become Radio Centre, a change that happened while I was on maternity leave, and during which I genuinely did feel unstable in a way that I hadn't, I think, when I left radio services. That role at CRCA was, it just felt like the platform from which I could really grow. I think that the development of an industry has to be in line with the external factors of the time. And just as those small-scale radio stations were able to exist because of changes in technology, changes in the national advertising market inevitably led us, I think, to the point eventually where we are now. I think you can't stop progress. And by progress, I don't necessarily mean improvement, but I just mean change. I mean, change will happen. And you have to allow a sector to thrive as best it can, depending on the external influences and factors that it's facing. And I think that consolidation was inevitable. And I actually think the sector was really hampered by having to wait so long for that consolidation. But it wasn't inevitable. Just because something could happen didn't mean that it would happen. And I also felt that a big chunk of my work was around making sure that the community radio operating framework, as it was at the time, was sufficiently distinctive from small-scale local commercial radio. I felt that my time was, and my energies were really deployed right across the sector, and not just in the interests of, you know, two or three big players. I mean, when I first joined CRCA, we had seven or eight kind of big groups in the industry, all much of a muchness of size, and they gradually consolidated over time. And I did feel throughout my time that I was working right across for the best interests of the sector as a whole, whether that was to do with community radio or ownership rules or broadcast advertising rules or working on BBC licence fee or service agreements for BBC new services, formation of the BBC Trust, the digital radio stuff. I did feel able to take a whole industry perspective, and only others can judge whether or not I did that sufficiently well. But I do think when you're in a leadership position, whether you're leading an organisation or leading a sector, you have to try and see it holistically and recognise that there will be some bits that will benefit one over the other, but you can still work in the interests of the whole.
And we could see quite clearly that we were going to lose a lot of share, and the only way we could get around that as an industry was to have bigger companies that could take on the national services.
I started as a part-time public affairs officer at CRCA, and during that process we as a family, or as a couple as we were then, relocated to the north of Scotland, and I came back to work part-time in London commuting, having had my daughter. And then I think it was when I was on maternity leave for the second time with my son that the merger of CRCA and the Radio Advertising Bureau happened and Radio Centre was formed. And I do remember very vividly sitting on my bed, having just put baby down for a nap, and Paul Brown phoning me and saying, well, you know, there's this new chap coming in to join and run Radio Centre, and I think you might have to accept that, you know, a part-time public affairs person might not work. And I thought to myself, bloody hell, I'm not having that. I like this too much. I love my job too much. And I damn well am going to show that I can do this job part-time for the north of Scotland. And I met Andrew Harrison while I was on maternity leave and struck up a really good working relationship with him. And I hope managed to persuade him, actually to the point where I did end up going up to 4 days and then became sort of director of external affairs. But the merger of the Radio Advertising Bureau and CRC was really interesting because I discovered two things. And I've been a feminist from my childhood. And when I was a member of CRCA, I published a document which CRCA sponsored called Women in Commercial Radio, which was quite interesting at the time. It talked about the sexism that women in the industry had faced. I think I published that in something like 2000 or 99 or something. And when we merged CRCA and Radio Advertising Bureau, we discovered that the men in the RAB earned a lot more than the women in CRCA for jobs that were of a similar level. And to his credit, Andrew Harrison fixed that. He recognised straight away that there was an equal pay issue and he fixed it. I guess within a couple of years, felt like I was sort of his right-hand person and became Director of Strategy at Radio Centre. I think most women who consider themselves to have had successful careers would say, you know, being a woman has never held me back. But I don't think you really know is the honest answer. None of us really knows whether the discrimination, behaviour, attitudes that we have been on the receiving end have changed the path of our career. I certainly experienced throughout my career stuff that I would say falls under the hashtag Me Too, for definite. I think it's hard to say whether it's held you back, because I think we all just try and push forward as far and as fast as I can. But my early years in the radio industry were not straightforward for women. The point I would make, and I have spoken about it before, you know, quite early in my career, I was sexually assaulted by a very high profile person. And that had an effect on me. And it changed how I behaved at work. And the simple fact is that a man in my position will not have to ask the question, did that change the course of my career? So that's why I think it's really hard to say, you know, was my career disadvantaged by being a woman? Well, I know I earn less. You know, any time I benchmarked my salary, any time in my career that I benchmarked my salary, I earn less than men who are doing similar jobs less well than I'm doing mine. One of the things that I'm really interested in is, you know, as I look around now at the work that Sound Women has done, and Sound Women is one of the things that I'm most proud of being a part of. Sound Women came into being when I was on maternity leave with my third child. It's the sort of thing I'd have been right at the heart of from the very beginning, and I got into it quite quickly and became part of working with that team, and I'm really, really proud of it. And I'm particularly proud, actually, that we decided to finish it when we did, because we thought, actually, we don't need to be an organisation anymore. This is now an industry issue that everybody owns. I do wonder what the world of radio, television, everything might be like now if women had had opportunities in broadcasting 20, 30 years ago that I know weren't there because of this myth, you know, men don't like listening to women on the radio and women don't like listening to women on the radio, and no one can ever find the piece of research upon that which that is apparently based. And the inevitable sexism that we know existed in the sector. I mean, it is not the case that men make better programme controllers than women, but for the entirety of my career as a radio executive, there were fewer women programme controllers than you could count on one hand. So how might life have been different if more than just half the population had been in those key creative roles? Those are the kind of issues that now, looking back, how might that have been different? And we're asking those questions now about people from BAME backgrounds as well. How might the world be different if we actually access the talent of everybody? And I had an amazing career in radio. My radio career finished, whether temporarily or permanently, quite early on. But I didn't really feel there was anywhere else for me to go. And I don't know whether that's because I'd reached the end of my talent or the industry was sick of me. There wasn't anywhere to go unless you were sort of the owner or the chief executive of a big group. It didn't feel there was anywhere else for me to go. And I don't know how much of that is because of me and how much because of my gender or whatever. But it remains the case that it was how I felt.
It is true that there were many in the BBC who felt that had the Thatcher government continued, then Radio 1 would be a candidate for privatisation. And don't forget that in 1986, the Peacock Committee actually recommended privatising both Radio 1 and Radio 2. So the loss of audience...
I really enjoyed my work on behalf of the sector in thinking about the BBC. The enormous market intervention that the BBC represents, and particularly that represented then in a, at that point, largely UK-owned media sector, was absolutely fascinating and brought me into the opportunity of working with a whole range of fascinating people. But I think digital radio, I mean, I still feel myself as the person responsible for stewarding the industry towards that Digital Economy Act and the digital switchover provisions in there, and all the work that we did to pull the BBC, commercial radio and Arqiva together at that point. That's the piece of work, and the secondment to Digital Radio UK for that piece of legislation is probably the work process of which I'm most proud. I think you can argue the extent to which it was the right decision for the industry to take, but my job wasn't to say whether or not it was the right decision for the industry to take, because it was the decision the industry wanted to take. My job was to make it happen. Being in charge of that piece of work was a real privilege.
Heart 106.2 begins broadcasting digitally at the end of June. Welcome to the next age of media, the digital age.
Radio Centre was a huge amount of fun, and I loved working right in the heart of London, and I loved being sort of the go-between EMAP as it was and Capital and GWR and working with those big brains and going to some fantastic concerts and those kind of things. But I also really liked the energy of the challenge, you know, when you know you knew there was a piece of legislation coming up and there was a deal that had to be done. And I remember doing a particularly gnarly piece of work. We knew we had to get to number 10 for a meeting with Stephen Carter. I think it was like 10:30 in the morning. We'd had the nod about 10 o'clock at night the night before, and Andrew Harrison and I working out the only way we could do this was if I didn't drive to the airport myself, but I got a taxi to the airport and I could do all the work on my laptop on the way to the airport, send it to him from Inverness Airport. He would work on it while I was on the plane. He'd then send it back to me when I landed at Gatwick, and then we'd kind of all coalesce for this big summit at a particular point to kind of do the deal around how we were going to pull the bit of legislation together. That was all really, really exciting stuff. But we also did fun things like, you know, the work we had around party conferences. I remember baking and icing. This is going right back to CRCA days. For commercial radio's, was it its 25th or its 30th anniversary? I remember baking 250 fairy cakes and icing the number 25 onto every single one of them and taking them down to Bournemouth. The party conferences really drove my love of lobbying. And I think if you would say, am I anything at heart? I'm fundamentally a lobbyist, as in I'm a persuader. I want to, like, bringing people together, finding a cause, bringing people together, persuading them of that cause, building the journey, taking them on that journey in a really exciting way. I think that was really the first time that I did it, when I went to CRCA and was asked to begin to raise the profile of commercial radio as a public service broadcaster, as a force for good, as something that politicians should be careful of the way they legislated, not kind of just to accept the myth around it of sort of pop and prattle, but to change the perception of the sector. Somebody once said, and I think they didn't mean it entirely flattering, that I'm a WYSIWYG person. What you see is what you get. I'm also a musician, and musicians learn to make music with people by getting into rhythm with them. So I do try really hard to understand what the fundamental motivation for people is. What is it that they care about? What element of that aligns with what I'm trying to do, or what I've been tasked to do? If you can make people feel that you really have genuinely understood them, not agreed with them, but understood them, and you've found the thing that they care about and that you care about, and you say, well, look, we might not like everything, but let's recognise that we've got some kind of shared purpose here. I think that helps. When I was in the middle of all the excitement around the Digital Economy Act, I had what was my third miscarriage, and it was a bit later than the others. And anyone who's had a miscarriage, and I include dads and mum as well as mums in that, will know how really, really hard they are. And work covered me brilliantly through that period. And Alice Dickerson, who's now very senior at the BBC and was very junior at Radio Centre at the time, just stepped in fantastically during that period. And I came back and we finished the work for Digital Radio UK, and then I had a little bit of time off over that summer, and then very happily fell pregnant again and have a beautiful third son. But I wonder if just all of that sort of slightly changed how I felt about things, and maybe changed how work felt about me. And Radio Centre had already gone through one set of cuts, and it was clear that it was going to have to trim its wings further. And there was a real moment for me of thinking, you know, I got out of radio services 10 years ago and found a whole new career for myself. Maybe I can do the same again. And I had a really good conversation with Andrew Harrison about it, and that was very much his view. And he said, well, look, you know, there is going to be some work here over the next couple of years. Why don't you go freelance? We'll give you a little bit of work as a kind of starting client. And that was to chair the Archivas, which was brilliant. And so I thought, well, I'm going to give this a go. And I knew how much money I had to earn to keep paying the mortgage. I'll give it a go as a consultant. And never having had a day off sick for years, February 2012, I had to go into hospital for an operation. So I was out of action for about 6 weeks on no sick pay. But then very quickly after that, I remember dropping Will Harding a note at Global and saying, you know, how are you? I've left Radio Centre. And he said, oh, had you? I haven't noticed. Oh, good. Thanks very much. I said, well, I've got a bit of work needing doing. Do you fancy doing that? And so I said, yeah, that'd be lovely. Gradually began to pick up bits of work. And my approach to consultancy was an interesting one. I remember speaking to John Myers before I went freelance, and he said to me, Lisa, you have to remember the thing about consultants is they should be reassuringly expensive. And you're really good, and people will expect to pay well for someone as good as you, and so don't undercharge. And I decided not to undercharge for my time, and as a result, I was able to make it as a consultant and make sure that I really gave my clients the very best possible attention when I was working for them, and built up a really nice portfolio. But the most interesting thing was moving out of radio. All of the journeys of my career being overlaps. And towards the end of 2012, Paul Brown, with whom I had worked at CRCA and who had become chairman of Radio Centre but then had retired, was a non-executive director at a company called Whitelink Ferries, the ferry company between Portsmouth, Lymington and the Isle of Wight. And they were about to undergo a company restructure. The company needed somebody to come in and manage the communications around the change. And, you know, when you meet someone and you really, really click with them, I really clicked with these guys and I started working for them. And that was my step out of radio. And over the following 6 years, I ended up working for a whole range of companies, many of them through Macquarie, the Macquarie Infrastructure Funds, because Whitelink was owned at that point by one of Macquarie's infrastructure funds, and they asked me then to go and work for a number of their other businesses. That transfer of my skills and my experience just very naturally migrated out of radio. Very early in my time after I left Classic, I received a phone call from Michael Bucht, who had been my programme controller at Classic, saying that he was on the board of a school in Canterbury called St Edmunds, and they were looking for some new governors, and would I be interested? And I thought, this sounded brilliant. So I became a governor at St Edmunds, and that's where I began a career as a non-executive. And all through my career, really from about a year after I left Classic, I've had non-executive directorships. So I was a governor of St Edmunds, and then I joined the board of the Canterbury Festival, a fabulous arts festival. And then my husband and I relocated to Somerset, and I stayed on the board of St Edmunds, but I joined the board of the Salisbury International Arts Festival. And then when we were relocating to the north of Scotland for my husband's job, I was really convinced that I was going to get a really interesting job in Scotland, and that the way to do that would be to keep working in London and to get some non-executive work. So when I'd been introduced to the chairman at Gordonstone, I thought, well, I'll join the board. Obviously, it's voluntary, but that would be a really interesting way. I'll make some connections. And I also applied to the board of Scottish Opera from an advert in The Times. And I was appointed to the board of Scottish Opera. And then I think a year later was made vice chairman of the board. And actually, the job in Scotland never came. And after about two or three years, I thought, this isn't going to work. I applied for two or three things and they didn't come off. You know, I got down to the last few and there was... I was just never the right person for them. I think they couldn't quite see how this person from radio could move into heritage or whatever it was. And I suppose during my time as a consultant, I think just about anybody who's been a consultant will tell you that it has an exhaustion about it that almost nothing else does. And it's a particular kind of exhaustion because you're trying to super serve everybody all at the same time. So I'd kind of thought that I might have a big job in me. I'd always thought there was a big job in me that I hadn't ever found in radio. So I began just to have a little look, and I was headhunted for a couple of things, but it just never felt right. And then the principal at Gordonstone resigned, and I thought, you know, that might just be the thing for me.
Gordonstone is home for me.
It's unique.
It's just about the experiences.
Experiences that you wouldn't usually learn at school.
The whole curriculum just pushes you.
Gordonstone was founded in 1934 by a man called Kurt Hahn. And Kurt Hahn had been a headmaster of a school in Germany called Zalem. When the Nazis were on the rise in Germany, there were obviously some really horrific things taking place. And he spoke out against the Nazis and said, you can be a friend of Zalem, his school, or you can be a friend of the Nazi party, but you can't be both. And he was imprisoned for this. And when he was released from prison, his friends basically advised him that his life would be in danger and so he should escape Germany. And he fled to the north of Scotland where he had connections. And he set up Gordonstone in the fundamental belief that if you give young people a sense of responsibility, a sense of challenge, then they will discover what they're really capable of, that it's only when you make young people needed that they really discover their true value and what they can do in the world. He'd had that because he'd seen young men return from the First World War, you know, who'd basically, you know, gone to war as a boy, come back as a man. It must be possible to give young people that sense of purpose without a sense of combat. And he also thought it was really important that young people mix with people who are different from them. So he set up Gordonstone, and from the very beginning, it had an incredibly diverse range of young people there. So its 10th pupil was the Duke of Edinburgh. But at that time, there were also, you know, local children, the children of local Fisher families in the school. So the fundamental principle of Gordonstone is that if you bring together young people from an incredibly diverse background, and that's but different skills, talents, socioeconomic, race, nationality, and you expose them to a uniquely broad curriculum and you give them a sense of purpose through being of service to others, then you create young people of character. And we believe that Gordonstone is the world leader in character education. It's an extraordinary place to work. I mean, it's a beautiful place to work. 200-acre campus, so many opportunities for the students, and a wonderful group of staff who are incredibly committed to this ethos. You were fundamentally an ethos-driven school. It's really hard work. I mean, running a boarding school, a 24/7 boarding school, is really hard work. I mean, obviously at the moment we're in lockdown, so we don't have children on campus. But the responsibility of hundreds of children sleeping every night and being in your care is like nothing I've ever experienced before. But it is wonderful to be part of an organisation that has an incredibly clear sense of its identity and whose purpose is really needed. I mean, I don't think there's ever been a time when we more need young people of genuine character who know how to put other people before themselves and who know how to overcome challenge, to face challenges, to be resilient, to give things a go. I think we've never needed young people like that more than we need them now. So there's an incredible sense of purpose. I do really love the sort of diversity of it. I love the fact that, you know, one minute I can be in chapel leading the school in a hymn practice. The next I'll be speaking to our partners in China about opening Gordonston in China, which is happening in a couple of years' time. I might then be dealing with alumni who will be speaking to our students about their exciting careers. I sailed to the Arctic. You know, I spent a week sailing in the Arctic with our students. Our students sail our own 80-foot sail training vessel from Scotland to the Arctic. They are the crew. Now, obviously, we have the safety of professional crew with them, but they're the ones doing the work, and I got to do that with them. That kind of diversity of a day is just fabulous.
They don't want you just to leave with free A's. They want you to develop as an individual.
Not just the subjects or even the outdoor education or the sports that are part of our curriculum, it's building yourself as a person.
I've always advised people when they work in radio not just to work in that narrow sector. And by narrow, I don't mean that radio is in any way anything other than diverse and fabulous and creative. But I think it's so important that when you work in one sector, you're still aware of others. And that's why I've always loved being on boards. And so I think, you know, for those people who are working in the sector now, I would say, even though you feel like you are working 24/7 at your job, find the time to be involved in something else, even on a voluntary basis, and practice the skill of transferability. At the moment, because we're in lockdown and we're having to do lots of planning at school for reopening in the autumn term, I'm doing staff addresses and live Q&As 3 times a week. And it is really interesting how much like broadcasting that feels, and therefore how completely natural it feels. But I do really believe that through the 20 years I spent in commercial radio, I did learn a huge amount. But the thing that I learned the most about was change. You know, the industry I entered, Classic FM, I joined Classic FM. I was interviewed at Classic FM on its first birthday. And when I left the sector, you know, it was so different. So much had changed. If you're going to do anything, you have to recognise that change is inevitable and is constant. I don't think you get anywhere if you rail against change. I think you have to work out, you know, how can I sort of steer this a little bit? Nothing will stay the same. So change is going to happen. So shape it, be part of shaping it. And if you do that, then if the change happens to you, you'll be so used to changing things and adapting to it that you'll be able to adapt yourself. The children in my school don't talk about radio very much. And my own children, the only time they listen to the radio is when they're listening to it through me. And I think that's a real challenge. And that's why I think going with the change that's happening is really critical. Video content is so vital. And we use it really extensively in our own marketing. The firm boundaries that used to exist between media self-evidently aren't there anymore. And I do think that's where, from a regulatory perspective, if I look back, the regulation of radio was just too slow to change. While the UK was a UK broadcasting sector, I think UK broadcasters were kept too small for too long. And I think that has not been for the good. I don't really know where I go next. I mean, I've got plenty to do at Gordonston. I've never really planned my career. Really interesting opportunities that have come my way, and I've found decisions really hard to make. I hope that as long as I keep stretching myself, keep challenging myself, and keep engaging with other people, that interesting opportunities will keep coming my way. I hope they do, because I haven't got a very good pension. I do love going on the Hulk roller coaster at Universal Studios with my kids. I mean, I really love that. And I love going to the beach on a lovely holiday, or, you know, playing in the pool if we're going on holiday with a family. And I love cooking and I love those things, but I do really like working. It's really sad. I love skiing. I suppose I'm that sort of second of momentary happiness is either when I'm skiing quite fast and quite well, or I conduct a choir. I conduct a choir in my spare time. I conduct a really wonderful local choir here that I've built with some friends, and there's only sort of 14 singers, but I really love it when we absolutely nail a concert. The adrenaline of that is like nothing else. I do love that. I don't think I could ever hope to be remembered as someone who made everybody, you know, laugh hysterically or anything like that. You know, people say, oh, I want to be remembered as funny. I don't think I'm a very funny person, but I'd like to think that I was someone that people felt modestly inspired by and well supported by. I suppose I'd really like people to feel that I did everything the very best I possibly could, and I just stuck at things really hard, and that they could count on me, that people could count on me, that I would be there for them.
Lisa Kerr. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast. I'm David Lloyd, and if you do make radio or podcast, then do grab my book called Radio Secrets. It's all about how to make powerful content for whatever platform. Chapters about everything in here. Just look at this. Authenticity, words, likability, interviewing, double acts, getting a reaction, voice tracking, The Breakfast Show, voice artistry, contesting. It's all in there with lots of quotes from people who know far more about these things than do I. So there we are. That's the book called Radio Secrets, available on Amazon or wherever you like, in ebook or paperback. Radio Secrets. I'm David Lloyd.